but will be the end of our series about Islam, and we'll be talking about Muslim arguments and disproving them by disproving some atheist arguments, and we got into that a little bit 2 weeks ago, and we'll finish up by finishing that up today. So this should be review, but I just wanted to clarify the argument again before we introduced it. The question that we're talking about is essentially the difference between religious warfare. So religious warfare, Muslims, that we would know as jihad, what is the difference between something like that and the Crusades? What's the difference between that and we all know that the Crusades are not something that we have to defend because they were wrong, and they were led by the Roman Catholic Church and by some political leaders in Europe, and were not something that was actually meant for the purpose that they said they were, which was to retake the Holy Land. And there was a lot of doctrinal issues surrounding the reward for the Crusaders. But when we talk about something that is in our Bible and that is a direct commandment from God, unlike the Crusades, Israel entering Canaan and wiping out those tribes, how do we as Christians defend that? Because we have to defend that. We have to be able to defend it, right? Because since it's a commandment of God, when someone says, what's the difference between that and other religious violence? Okay? Someone who's an atheist, somebody who's an unbeliever, somebody who belongs to a different religious group, that, you know, maybe doesn't have a history of violence attached to it like Christianity, in quotation marks, and Islam, they would point the finger and say, well, it's really easy for a Christian to judge everyone else when your religion is just as guilty of violence. And even if we don't talk about recent history, let's go all the way back to Israel, they were perpetrators of some of the worst kinds of violence. So how do you defend that? And then the root of that argument, therefore, is whether our Christian God, and I'm using that correctly now, the true Christian God, is inherently good, merciful, and holy. So because we're starting at that point, you have to start with something that's a concrete truth. We know God is inherently good, merciful, and holy. He is the, I don't know if embodiment is a word because he's not necessarily a body, but he is those things. They are inseparable from him. And our definition of what is good and merciful and holy is rooted in him. Have you ever thought about that? Just morality across the board. If you think about what's good and what's bad, how do you arrive at the conclusion as to what's good and what's bad? All of it has to be traced back to God and his character. And he is the definition of what that is. So you are basically looking for, in the Bible, examples of God making decisions similar to a decision that you have to make, or someone that's following God, obedient to God, making decisions similar to what you have to make, and that's what you're basing your life on. And why is Pastor preaching this extended series about the book of Acts of the Apostles? Why is it important that we know the Acts of the Apostles? So we can follow them. They were obedient to God, and because of God's nature, we know that we can follow in their footsteps and that we'd be on the right track. Okay? So that's why we're talking about not specifically Christianity versus Islam, but Christianity versus atheism as well, because both sides may potentially attack the inherent goodness of our God and the God that we worship. So now that we have the reason as to why we're talking about this in general, why do we have to address this? Okay, so why even go this route to begin with? Okay, and in this day and age, it's very easy to avoid conversations that are uncomfortable, to not address certain situations, and then basically just pass it off as you're being tolerant, or you don't want to make someone upset, or maybe I don't really understand what it is actually that they're saying, okay? And all of that is just kind of an easy way out. The easy thing to do is to allow people to say things that are incorrect, that might even be blasphemous, just allow them to say it, because silence in that situation, it requires the least amount of effort on your part. And then we can just kind of pass it off using, you know, whatever other kinds of misapplications of scripture that we can find, you know, whether it's turn the other cheek, whether it's, you know, judge not. And so we misapply those passages of scripture to give us an out as to why we don't confront people when they really just attack our religion and attack specifically our God. And I left my phone back here, and I need to read that passage. So if you'd all turn to 1 Samuel 17, some of you already know what you're turning to. This is the story of David and Goliath. Probably one of the most rousing stories, historical records in the Bible itself, because of David's attitude, because of his courage, because of his not just assault in response to Goliath, but his physical assault and how he led men against an insurmountable foe. We're Americans, we love the underdog story, and this fits that perfectly. David is the ultimate underdog against Goliath, who is the ultimate favorite. If this was a boxing match, the bettors wouldn't even put any money on the fight at all, because there would be no point, right? Everybody knows who's going to win, so there'd be no bets to place. Nobody would accept them, right? And yet, we have this awesome story of David and his intolerance of what Goliath is saying and doing, not just to the children of Israel, but to God himself. So in 1 Samuel 17, 8, this is Goliath. And Goliath stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, "Why are ye come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine and ye servants to Saul? Choose you a man for you, and let him come down to me. If he be able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. And now jump down to verse 22. And David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage, and this is what he was bringing to his brothers, and ran into the army and came and saluted his brethren. And as he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and spake according to the same words that we just read. And David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have ye seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up. And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." And David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, "What shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine, who taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him after this manner, saying, "So shall it be done to the man that killeth him." And now again, jump down to verse 41. And the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and David and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy and of fair countenance. And the Philistine said unto David, "Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and the beasts of the field." Then David said to the Philistine, "Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into my hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give the carcasses of the hosts of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with the sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." Isn't that just, that response is, that's got to be some of my favorite verses in the entire Bible. Complete intolerance on David's part. This is a kid, this is a teenager, most common at this time, who doesn't even know what's going on when he arrives at this battle. Not completely. He knows generally, you know, the Israelites are fighting the Philistines, has no idea. He hears Goliath give his speech, blaspheming God and his armies, and he's like, no, not putting up with that. And he doesn't care if nobody from Israel's army is behind him. And you have to believe at that point that, I mean, God, David believes that God is going to give Goliath into his hand, right? But do you think that there is probably, you know, some doubt in David's mind? I mean, maybe God will use him being killed at the hands of the Philistine just as easily as he would use him conquering the Philistine. But he's going to do the right thing either way. And for whatever reason, God gave him faith in this confrontation that Goliath would actually be killed and that he would be the one that was victorious. Because he says, I'm going to kill you and I'm going to give your carcass and the carcasses of all the other soldiers in your army, I'm going to give it to the fowls of the air. So he knows that he's going to win, but he's still human. And confronting this giant is still not an easy task. And I would say that even in that situation, knowing David like we do based on the Bible, even if he knew that he was going to lose and that the roles would be reversed, that Goliath was actually going to behead him, he still would have done the same thing. And I believe if David was here, he would tell you he would have. And I just wonder how many Christians that there are today that would do that. And I would say that it's an extremely small percentage, a very small fraction of Christians that would actually stand up. Because we don't even have Christians today that will stand up and give an argument on behalf of God or behalf of his people. They won't do it. Whenever there's significant debates between people about the existence of God, how often is it that the person arguing against the atheist is actually truly a believer? And I can tell you, based on just my exposure to those types of debates, it's not as often as you think. There's a lot of times when an unsaved person, someone who does not believe in Jesus and the work that he did, is the person that's arguing against the atheist for the existence of God. There's just this void of Christians who will not say or do anything. You go, well, how can that be? Why can that be? Because of ease. Right? And so when it comes time, and I believe that there is going to come a time, I don't know when, it may be my lifetime, it may not be, but at some point, well, I guess we know that it's happening today. Christians are going to be forced to make a decision that's going to either force them to defend God or potentially lose their life, their family, their home. And I'm just not very confident that there's a lot of other Christians that I want standing next to me, because I think that most of them would probably give up. And I think that there's a lot of Christians that would end up turning in other Christians in that type of scenario to save themselves. You go, well, certainly nobody in this church. Hopefully not. Hopefully not. Right? But you really find out what you're made of when somebody actually attacks you. I have this note here because, you know, Jesus talks about turning the other cheek. He talks about, you know, different ways to handle confrontation. And one thing that I've noticed is that when Jesus talks about that, he's talking about somebody personally attacking you. So if somebody's going after you specifically and they're calling you names, that's when a Christian's, I guess, passive mentality should be a little bit more active. Where, listen, I can take it. If you're going to make fun of me, if you're going to call me names, if you're going to beat me, then I'll turn the other cheek. I'll take that. I'll shoulder that. If you're going to attack other people or you're going to attack God, that's when we get this idea of defense. That's when Jesus goes into the temple and drives the money changers out with a whip. And if you think that he just had the whip to intimidate people, you're wrong. Because he could intimidate people without it. He was using it. So I think we misapply scripture again to give us a way out and say we don't have to respond to these types of attacks. And that's where this argument from Sam Harris comes in. And I'm going to read it again because Sam Harris, and as I read it, think about what he's saying about God and think about what Goliath said about God. If God exists, either he can do nothing to stop the most egregious calamities or he does not care to. God, therefore, is either impotent or evil. Pious readers will now execute the following pirouette. God cannot be judged by merely human standards of morality, which is true. But of course, human standards of morality are precisely what the faithful use to establish God's goodness in the first place. And any God who could concern himself with something as trivial as gay marriage or the name by which he is addressed in prayer is not as inscrutable as all that. If he exists, the God of Abraham is not merely unworthy of the immensity of creation, he is unworthy even of man. There's another possibility, of course, and it is both the most reasonable and least odious. The biblical God is a fiction. It is terrible that we all die and lose everything we love. It is doubly terrible that so many human beings suffer needlessly while alive. That so much of this suffering can be directly attributed to religion, to religious hatreds, wars, delusions, diversions of scarce resources, is what makes atheism a moral and intellectual necessity. It is a necessity, however, because the atheist at the margins of society. The atheist, by merely being in touch with reality, appears shamefully out of touch with the fantasy life of neighbors. And then we just change slides, right? And we, well, Sam Harris, what does he know? We don't have to address his terrible argument, right? We can just say, God will take care of Sam Harris. You know, and if Sam Harris presents an argument that we can't answer to, we'll just say, I don't understand everything about God, so. Listen, it's your responsibility to be better than that. Because if we don't have anybody to stand up against Sam Harris and the blasphemous things that he says about God, then Christianity is a lot worse off than all of us really suppose. And so my goal today is to make sure that none of you are truly in a position where you don't know how to respond to at least this type of argument. And I can't go through everything, right? But I do know that both atheists and Muslims are going to approach you with this whataboutism of history. Well, what about this? That is a contradiction. That makes you a hypocrite because you're judging these people, but your religion does the same thing. Again, whenever you're looking at an argument like this, on the surface, you just kind of want to have some kind of knee-jerk reaction to it. And, you know, if Sam Harris was the one that was, you know, angrily spouting the speech that I just gave in your face, some of you may just haul off and hit him. And maybe that response is justified. But we really have to think about, because that's not going to solve it, right? He's just going to go, well, see, you proved my point. Okay? We really have to use logic and reason, and I'm not talking about man's logic and reason. I'm talking about biblical logic and reason to refute this type of argument because does God exist? Yes. Does the Bible teach us that he is none of those things? He's none of those things that Sam Harris attests that he is, right? So how do we tell Sam Harris everything that you said there is wrong? It starts here. Where does the concept of good and bad originate? Where is Sam Harris getting his idea of God being bad? Right, and he, you know, if you read the entire excerpt from his book there, Atheist Manifesto, then you'd kind of get more of the full picture. And all of the things, you know, he comes up with the most terrible crimes that you can imagine being committed that will continue to be committed continually. If you think about how many people are murdered daily across the world, and not just like, but like murdered in terrible ways by people that are full of hate. Continually, as we're speaking here in Sunday school, people are being killed. And God is allowing that to happen, right? So that's Sam Harris. He's like, all of these people are dying and all of these crimes are being committed. And the most horrific thing that you can think about, crimes against children, all that kind of stuff. That's just going on perpetually and God's not doing anything about it. Okay, so let's not address, the whole argument. Let's talk about this. So Sam Harris, you are at least admitting that there is a standard of morality, right? Because his standard of morality is what he's basing his argument on, that God doesn't exist. So because morality exists and God allows immoral things to happen, God doesn't exist. And I think if he was here, he and a lot of other atheists would say, yeah, you boiled it down pretty accurately. So where does Sam Harris get to come in and say, here's the standard of morality? There's no God, so where does he get his idea of it? Where does that come from in the first place? So we know murdering people is bad. Why is it bad? If you know that there's no God and there's no judge and you're not going to get caught, and I don't like somebody and they're in my way of what I want to accomplish in my life, why wouldn't I just kill them? Right? So in his argument, disproving God, he's actually just disproving for himself that morality exists in the first place. Because if there's no God, then there's no morality. And if there's no morality, then there might be a God, because that's what, do you guys understand what I'm saying? So because morality exists, it leads us to this idea that if there's a higher definition of what is good and bad, which is God, and basing his ideas on, then all of a sudden at the outset, he has issues. Okay? Yes? Well, I think that they would say, if you're going to ascribe the good things that happen to your life to God, then you also have to ascribe the bad things. And if God is in control of the bad things, then isn't God by his nature not inherently good? And that's probably the logic that they would use. I don't think that it's a bad thing, because you're right. Like, they're really just using very negative arguments to disprove God's existence, as opposed to, life and creation and all of the good things that come with it itself. So there is something to that, right? Joy, love, positive emotions, where do those come from, right? But all the bad stuff you want to ascribe to God, none of the good stuff you want to give to him. So I don't think it's a bad argument, but I think that they might come back with what I responded. Yes, Mrs. Rortel. Yeah, it's very subjective, right? So if there's no higher definition, there's no divine definition of good and bad that we get all of our morality from, then we're in big trouble, because everything in our society is based on that definition. And the assumption is that all of us will share the same types of ideas. Murder is bad, stealing is bad, all of that stuff is bad. Why is all of that stuff bad? That's why our culture and is crumbling, because you're taking away the reason that all of that stuff is bad. And people are going, okay, so theft is bad because why? Well, it hurts somebody else. Well, it helps me because I'm stealing it. So what difference does it make? Right? And it used to be said that because we have this principle of divine perfection, that we can ascribe all of these positive attributes to. Anything that betrays those attributes is therefore bad, and it's bad for society. But we take God out of everything, and we expect the definition of morality to just say stay suspended in midair with nothing underneath it. Okay? God has to be the one that's holding that up, because otherwise you have subjectivity. You have my truth. You have what's good for me. And who is to say that what's good for you isn't actually what's good? Because if what's good for you is bad for somebody else, and what's good for them is bad for you, then who's right? Both of you are right. That's a dumb response. They can't both be right. They can't. Because then ultimately that person is going to get you out of the way, right? They're going to have license to do whatever they need to do to get what they need from you. And again, it just presents so much of an issue. And atheists are working overtime trying to answer this question that Christians will pose to atheists. That you're saying God is bad, but how do you even get to define what's good and bad? Because you don't believe in God. So does that just come from culture? Does that just come from like a made-up thing? A bunch of humans just got together and we decided that murder is bad? No, it's got to come from somewhere. It's got to be rooted in something, or in our case, someone, capital S, right? So the core of this argument, at least this portion of it that I read, it reverses the role of the creator and the created, allowing the created to disprove the existence of the former, the creator, based on the created, and I put there in parentheses, created's possessive judgments of right and wrong. So instead of God standing in judgment of us and what we do, Sam Harris is standing in judgment of God. And now Sam Harris's definition of what's good and bad is what he's holding God to. You see that? So, to use an old expression, who died and made Sam Harris king? Right? Because where did you, are you representing all of humanity in saying that your standard of morality is now the standard of morality that we're going to hold everybody to? Where do you get off? So any of us can do that now? We can just say, my standard of morality is what I'm going to hold everybody to, including your fake God. And the reason he doesn't exist is because he does things that I don't like. Wow. That he doesn't hold any political office. He really hasn't won enough awards to really stand in judgment of all these people, including God, certainly. So how would an atheist answer that? So what put you in a position that you get to be the judge of that? Why do you get to do that? And you're saying now that all of us get to do that? All of us get to judge each other? Because he's still admitting that people who lie, cheat, and steal are still doing the wrong thing. So are you going to be the person that enforces all of that, all of those laws on everyone else? Or are we just supposed to come on nothing and say, yeah, we say all that's bad, and we're just going to let a group of other people say, yeah, all that's good? So they're going to continue to lie, cheat, and steal. We're going to try to get them to stop lie, cheating, and steal by just telling them, hey, we don't like that. Essentially, that's what he's saying. Based on nothing, just the fact that I don't like it when you lie, cheat, and steal. I just don't like it. Somebody else might like it. So again, it ignores the foundation of the argument. Jordan Peterson is one of these people that continually argues for the existence of what he calls the divine, and he would even admit that it is God. And there's even some evidence that's very recent that suggests that Jordan Peterson might have been saved. He was very, very heavily that way, and I have to confirm that. But I've seen some of his recent views that suggest that he may have become a believer. I don't know that, though. But this is a quote from him. To make a rational argument, you have to have an initial proposition. And that's entirely what we just spent the last 15 minutes trying to establish, an initial proposition. The proposition that underlies Western culture is that there is a transcendent morality. It's what we just talked about. Transcendent means it's above us. Okay? It's not something that we've come up with as humans. It transcends us. Okay? It comes from the divine. The ethic that drives our culture is predicated on the idea of God, and that's the ethic that Sam Harris is using. And you can't just take that idea away and expect the thing, and the thing that he's talking about is that transcendent morality, to remain intact, midair, without any foundational support. And he actually, in this picture that he's giving, addresses Sam Harris specifically, and he says, one of the issues that I have with atheist argument against the existence of God is that it's illogical because of this very idea. You're just expecting people to continue to be moral. And from so many different points of view, regardless of what you're, you know, if you're a professor, if you work in an oil field, if it doesn't matter what you do, from so many people's perspective, that's not going to work. You can't just expect people to continue doing the right thing for no apparent reason other than we just kind of think so. Right? And that's, he's really getting at the heart of the issue. The transcendent morality that underlies our culture is the existence of God, and that there is ultimately a judge who knows everything that you do, who has a perfect definition of right and wrong, and will hold you personally accountable for all of those things. Right? And that's where Jesus comes in, right? Because we know that we can't live up to that standard. That regardless of what we try to do in our lives, we're never going to be able to stand before God and say, I have done everything that I could in my own power to stand before you, and I am perfectly just. It's not going to happen. God demands perfection, and we can't achieve it. So Jesus has to be the perfection for us. He's the propitiation. He took on all of the bad things that we did on himself and took that punishment that God would have given to us so that we could stand before him clothed in God, in Jesus' righteousness. And that's the old story that never gets old. And I know I'm to people that have probably heard it hundreds of times, but I'll say it again because it's worth saying. That is incredible. Here's a perfectly just God who is perfectly willing to cast judgment on his son as opposed to you. And if that isn't a message that resounds in your heart, then you are the people in the Bible that God talks about. Your heart's closed. Because that is a powerful, powerful message. So, kind of going back to this, is the sound going to, there's no reason that the sound wouldn't work, right, Rod? Okay.
Bonus content, new episodes, and a clip of Jordan Peterson in debate that you won't find here on YouTube.
As you can see,
I have a toddler. Sign up at thebigconversation.show.
When horrible things happen to me, or I feel, or I...
Okay, I'm just going to she's an atheist, blue-haired atheist at that, and they're talking about the lack of purpose that atheists have to feel, because if there's no existence of God, and right and wrong are subjective, there can't be a purpose to your life. You're just kind of going through it, and your actions and what you do and what you decide are really meaningless, because ultimately, nothing's going to come of them. There's no everlasting goodness. There's no everlasting love or anything like that. Any love or good things that you do, you know, when you die, they just kind of go away and somebody could just take them and it doesn't matter anymore. So she's going to try to approach that, address this seeming meaninglessness in an atheist life.
Some terrible thing going on in the world. Yes, those are tragedies going on in the world. My response is, nothing matters. It's all empty and meaningless. This is how the world is. Get used to it. Get on
with
it, girl.
She's not being facetious.
That sounds like a very Zen Buddhist way of dealing with
meaning. I guess it is.
Well, it's a paradoxical way, though.
It is kind of paradoxical.
The first part of that is nihilistic, and the second part isn't. So how do you reconcile those two things? Why get on with it, girl?
Because...
Nihilism? Anyone know what that is? If you're nihilistic? She is definitely a nihilist in what she said. Those are people that nothing matters, nothing exists, life is meaningless. Life is pointless.
Well, here's another thing. I've often done this with my students. Let's suppose you become nihilistic. Nothing matters. There's no point in doing that. I mean, I think we live in a pointless universe. What are you going to do? And I say to them, like William James in his wonderful thing about getting up in the morning, but that's a slightly different point that he makes there. But I say to them, okay, tomorrow morning, when you wake up, think it's all pointless. There's no point in doing anything. Now, what are you going to do? Well, actually, you're going to need to go to the loo. You're going to get out of bed and you're going to go to the bathroom. And when you're there, you'll think, well, actually, I'm hungry. I think I want to go down to the kitchen. Oh, I probably should put my slippers on. Why don't I get dressed? You go and have something to eat. And then you think, I'm bored. And you go to university and go into your lectures. And, you know, we are not creatures who will just not do anything. To me, to go through that process, which I've done in the past a lot, and it's just natural now, is a very positive way of living. To accept the meaningless and ultimate emptiness of everything and accept that this creature here, this thing, this evolved creature just will get on with life.
But you're not accepting the meaninglessness of it, even by going through those actions that you describe.
You don't think so?
Not at all. Because you're acting as if those things are meaningful.
Yes, I am. I'm acting as though those things are meaningful.
Are you pretending that they're meaningful?
Pardon?
Are you pretending that they're meaningful?
No, I'm not pretending. I'm my way of putting it would be that those meanings are constructed by myself and others.
They're personal.
And they're because the kind of creatures we are, because of the meme.
But they're not constructed.
I'd like to hear
Jordan's responses. Hunger isn't constructed, neither is your desire to use the loo. None of that's constructed.
No, but the fact that there is a loo is part
of
culture.
Yeah, well, thank God for that.
Thank God we're using that. Sorry, that's a poor joke.
Well, you see, so imagine this. You have the proximal meanings that you described that are sort of a priori, right?
Yep.
They're handed to you. You might consider them as needs or drives, although they're not. They're personalities. It's not the right way of conceptualizing them. But then there's the intermingling of all those needs and drives, let's say. And that constitutes a new layer of structure, because it isn't just that you have to eat and that you have to use the washroom and that you have to have something to drink and that you have to be warm enough or cool enough to survive. It's that you have to do all those things at the same time in a situation where you're going to have to propagate that across time, and you're going to have to do it with a bunch of other people. Yep. And it's always been like that. And so what that means is that out of those proximal meanings, higher meanings arise. And you might say, well, those meanings are arbitrary, and I would think those are religious meanings.
I wouldn't say they are arbitrary, but I would say they were constructed. It's very interesting.
What do you mean by constructed?
They are a consequence of memetic evolution, of the language that people are brought up in, the culture they live in, the arguments they have. I mean,
what about the biology that they're given?
Well, we start with the biology, and the memes build on top of that.
Now, the memes are biology too.
Well, by definition, they are. Well,
see, this is the thing.
I would follow Dawkins in saying, "Well, talk about genes as biology, talk about memes as culture." That's all I meant by dividing that. But let me say this.
Yeah, but I don't accept that division.
But I want to get back to what we're saying about meaning. Reading your book made me think a lot about what you mean by meaning, and your claim that we should have a meaningful life or strive for a meaningful life. That meaningfulness is important, and I kept asking myself, do I live that way? What meanings does my life have? And, you know, if I think of something like, well, that most of my striving goes into writing my books. And is that meaningful? And again, I have the same response when I ask myself that question. It's just what this body does.
You should listen to the body and stop listening to the thing that's criticizing it.
And what would the body say?
It would say, write your book and try to be as clear as you possibly can.
Yeah, that's
about
what I do. And that's exactly what I do.
What I said at the beginning is that the atheist types act out a religious structure and criticize it.
No, there's no religious structure. I
thoroughly enjoy listening to Jordan Peterson because he is so patient and thought out when he's having these discussions with people. You could see, like, his last statement, which was basically just a sentence out of 6 minutes of discussion, ended the argument because he listened and asked questions the entire time and did some refuting, but asked her to really define what it is that she believed so that she walked right into what he was saying, right? So what he said there at the end is that his major issue with atheists is that they live a religious life a religious structured life and then mock religious people. Now, what does that mean? Okay. So if you are an atheist and you believe that everything is meaningless, but like the lady who was there in that discussion, she continues to do meaningless things, maybe not pretending, but just doing them anyway. Just go through the motions. Meaningless things like teaching her classes and because fundamentally everything is meaningless. She's a nihilist, right? So she has a life that is structured like someone who believes that God exists and does the right thing because there's a transcendent morality. She doesn't believe in the transcendent morality, but she still goes through the motions like she's someone that is religious. Because if she truly acted out what her body was telling her, that everything is meaningless and that there's no point to life, she'd either commit suicide or she'd never get out of bed. Right? So she's living this fantasy life in her eyes anyway, this fantasy life of doing the right thing and being a person who's not a mass murderer or doing all of these terrible things. She continues to do it just like a religious person would do, but then says, oh, you're so ignorant for believing in God. At least they're living out their faith. They actually believe that what they're doing is the right thing. You're just pretending. At its core, that's all she's doing. Yes? Well, and that's where the psychologist in Jordan Peterson was kind of coming out when he's talking about needs versus drives and biological tendencies and that type of thing. And so, there's definitely a deeper dive that we can do. But yeah, like she's certainly contradicting herself in the way that she's presenting this argument. So just to wrap up really quick, essentially what this comes down to, whatever you're talking about, whether you're talking about the children of Israel going into Canaan, whether you're talking about the New Testament, God is not bound by man of what's fair, right? Read the book of Job, okay? And things that we say are bad are difficult to actually define as bad. And I think I actually do want to end with this. I'll be quick, and I apologize if I don't get to this last bullet of witnessing to Muslims, because I know that that's kind of the core at, man, I wish I had more time. I'll be as brief as I possibly can. So most of you know what happened to my dad and I 10 years ago. There is not a single person that I've ever met who's found out about that and thought, man, that's great for you guys. So happy for you, right? No, everybody, it's absolutely, that is terrible. That is terrible. That is, like, some people just can't even wrap their minds around it, right? Just such a tragedy, right? And then the following weeks and just the things that my dad and I struggled with and still struggle with today, right? It's just bad. But I cannot tell you how this type of approach has given me so much more faith in God than I had before, because it wasn't bad. God doesn't do bad things. Okay, this is something that was outside of everyone's control, right? And so we're not even talking about like God allowing people to do bad things. We're just talking about the bad things happening in general. Okay, it was bad because it of the emotions maybe that it drove and the suffering and the different things that happened to other people as a result of it. But God, if God is in control of something like that, then it's not bad. And I am not going to be Sam Harris. I'm not going to stand in judgment of God and tell him what you did was bad and you're a bad God for that. Because the Bible teaches me that one of the most terrible things that you can do. And even kind of related to that unforgivable sin that Jesus talks about, people ascribing wickedness to God. Specifically, Jesus talks about the Holy Spirit. But that's why I say it's kind of related to that, where you are standing as a human, as a created person, you're standing in judgment of God and saying, you did a bad thing. You did an evil thing. That is a serious accusation. And people that God that have made those accusations, I believe the judgment is going to be absolutely, undeniably fair, to use this word. But it's going to be swift, and it will be an example. God establishes authority as the ultimate being of justice. So, witnessing to Muslims. Muslims are unbelievers. Okay, Abrahamic religions are related to each other, but, and they would say, right, you know, the Jewish God, the Catholic God, I'm using those little g's. At the heart of it, they believe in different gods. Allah is not God. He's not. He's not the God that we worship. Neither is the Jewish God, because they don't believe in the Trinity. So if you're looking at it from a strictly religious point of view, do we all believe in the same God, little g, historically? Yes. In reality, is it the same God? No, it is not. And so that's really where you have to start with Muslims, because they believe that their religion is related to Christianity and Judaism, and therefore we're essentially all worshiping the same being. But you have to start at square one, just like you'd be witnessing to an atheist. Say, no, let me tell you about our God. Not the same as Allah. It's not the same. Understanding historical context of it, like we went through in these lessons, that's important, because you can understand where they're coming from better. But at its foundation, it's not the same God. Okay, and we'll close with, I'll just let you guys write that down if you want to, and go to Matthew 7, 22 to 23. But we'll close in prayer, and then that'll be the end of our unit.